my goodness. Oh my goodness.
Hello, everyone. I'm Molly Wood. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, where we're trying to make today make sense. We already bummed ourselves out starting the show talking about our poor children trapped at home, but we're doing it. We're doing it. We got this. We're making it make sense.
Getting by.
Somehow.
Getting by. It's What Do You Want to Know Wednesday. It is time for us to answer your most pressing questions, which we will, of course, do post haste, I think.
Yes. Thank you to all of you who have been sending us questions. We really, really appreciate it. We get your emails. We get your voicemails. We try to choose the ones we think we can add value to. And here we go. As the Senate moves, as the Senate moves to finalize some version of its COVID relief bill. True story, today I was like, I'm making a new rule, which is that every time I want to look at Twitter, instead, I'm going to do 5 squats, push-ups, and a plank. Like,
oh, that's a good rule.
This is not good for me. Yeah. Yeah, I've done a lot. I'm getting a little sore. I'm exhausted. But that's how nihilistic it feels right now. But anyway, to your questions. As the Senate moves to finalize this COVID relief bill, we did get a question from Sam, who runs, and this sounds awesome, a custom shoe business in Ohio.
Oh, hey, guys, love the show. Just a quick question. In the new $1.9 trillion Biden package, what do we have for small businesses beyond what's already happened with the PPP and the second door PPP and the EIDL? Been scouring and trying to find out the provisions, and every time I do a search, haven't found very much. So any help you can give in this direction would be great. Thanks.
Wow. Excellent. All right. So look, he knows about the PPP, the Paycheck Protection Program. He knows about EIDL, which stands for, thank you, Marissa Cabrera, the Economic Injury Disaster Loan Program, $15 billion worth of that. Lots of stuff from the Small Business Administration, $25 billion in there. This one's my favorite, $1.25 billion for the SBA's Shuttered Venue Operators Grant Program. We do an interview series with a woman down in Nashville who runs an independent theater, and that Shuttered Venues grant has been instrumental for her getting the arts out there in Nashville. So there is a decent amount of stuff, but look, the bulk of the bill is unemployment insurance assistance, the extra money for people who've lost income, and also the $1,400 checks, right? That's where most of that money is going.
I think my understanding, too, is that PPP was re-upped separately, right? Like there is additional funding for PPP loans, but the program is still – it probably doesn't show up as like a brand new thing because it's sort of same program, a little more money.
Yeah.
Is my understanding.
Totally. And Sam, if you're if you're a micro business, there's a special like 2-week window, which I think expires either, no, it's not today. I think it's next week, for businesses with fewer than 20 employees. So dig into that one as well. Obviously you have to have a relationship with a lender and stuff, but there's a decent amount of stuff in here for the really micro and small kinds of businesses. So it's not, you know, it's not great. It's not bad. There are business tax credit issues as well that have to be discussed. But right now, what's happening with that bill, by the way, my favorite part of this is that Ron Johnson, Republican senator for Wisconsin, is going to make the Senate clerk read the bill. The thing is like 580 pages long, and Senator Johnson, who is opposed to it, is going to make the clerk read it. So that'll tell you what's in it if you want to tune into C-SPAN for the next 10 hours.
Hey, there you go. That's very true. You will get your chance to find out every gosh darn thing because if you're going to plant your flag anywhere, by God, plant it in opposition to the bill that has 77% American support, including 59% support among Republicans. Definitely. Yeah. That's the hill to die on.
Whew. So we did climate adaptation earlier this millennium. I don't know. It all kind of blurs together. Anyway, got this from Denise in Florida. Here's what she wants to know.
Hi, Molly and Kai. I'm seeing car makers announce plans for 100% electric vehicles next to headlines about recent Texas power outages and your recent coverage on resiliency. I'm wondering what role those car manufacturers are or should be playing in creating and sustaining the infrastructure to support electric vehicles. We are looking at buying our next car, and the only thing standing in our way of choosing a fully electric option is knowing that if a hurricane comes our way, I would be more comfortable with a gas-powered SUV. It's also possible that that comfort is just what I'm used to and not actually the better option, because we also see gas stations run out of fuel when a storm is coming. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Thanks so much.
Yeah, that's a really good question.
Yeah, I mean, one of the smartest things that Tesla did, in addition to, and it should be said, as many times as we are snotty about Elon Musk, and by we, I mean me, and by as many times, I mean often, I should still say that spinning up an American car manufacturer for the first time in however many decades is a remarkable accomplishment. And it was combined with some actual infrastructure build out, which is very smart. Yeah. This is, though, a huge stumbling block for car makers, and they should probably put up the money and kind of don't want to. They've actually asked the government to help with infrastructure investment for electric cars. Part of, actually, the Biden administration's climate plan includes that, the 500,000 new electric vehicle chargers. I think 2020 or GM has done some work to try to improve that infrastructure. It is really the key. I will say I have said the same thing about not the hurricanes. Like for years, I've been saying I didn't want an electric car as my only vehicle because if the zombies come, I want to be able to like get gas out of the ground. Thank you to Marissa for pointing out that there are 41,000 electric public charging stations in the U.S. and only 150,000 gas stations, which is a good note. And she reminded me, we talked about this question earlier on the show, and she reminded me of this time years ago when the Model S first came out. Like, you know, Tesla had I've been at this for a while. I went down to like drive the brand new Tesla and talk to them about what they were doing. And I told this guy who was like a Tesla VP, I'm nervous about an electric car because when the zombies come, I want to be able to get gas. And he said, just sharp as a tack, he goes, oh, well, when the zombies come, you actually totally want a Tesla because our whole infrastructure is solar. And so it doesn't take any electricity. Oh, man. And you'll be able to charge anywhere. And I was like, good pivot, Tesla guy. And he's like, thanks. No one's ever asked me about the zombie thing before. And then a few weeks later, on an earnings call, Elon Musk brought up zombies and their solar powered infrastructure. And I was like, that's too funny.
That's
all me.
Elon Musk stole my ideas. Oh my goodness. You know what I think? You know what I think he did actually? And look, I say what you will about Elon Musk because all of it's probably true, right? But he made electric vehicles sexy. That's the thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? He really did. And now everybody's like, ooh, I want an electric car.
And then key innovations around that. First of all, they look good. Second, they have range. Third, they can charge quickly. There's kind of the supercharging innovation. Like there is a lot in there that has made it way, way, way more palatable than people would have ever thought. But listen, I hear you. Like the range anxiety is real. And it is comforting to think that you would find some way to hand pump gas out of the ground, which you wouldn't. I mean, in a real emergency, like you're really not going to. You know, if the gas stations are closed and the power's out, you're probably not going to be able to get gas out of there. So I'm not sure. It might be same. All the disaster movies have all the abandoned cars on the side of the road. So I think it might be like 6 of 1 at this point.
Totally.
We talk all the time about consumer spending, all the time, on all the shows.
All the time.
And Oda has a question about it. She writes, where do those numbers actually come from? I wonder why, she says, consumer spending is up when so many are currently struggling with even paying for rent and food. Do those numbers primarily reflect the group of people who have more than enough money to spend? And if so, does this not skew the whole picture about consumer spending?
That's a really good question. So a couple of things. Number one, the data comes from the Bureau of Economic Analysis. So obviously government data, because they track this thing really closely. The other thing you need to know about it before we get into the nitty gritty is that it is spending by or on behalf of consumers. That thing you hear all the time about American consumer spending being 70% of this economy, it is spending by consumers or on behalf of consumers. And those are government payments. Those are corporate payments. Take your pick. So it's not just me going to the store and taking $20 out of my wallet and spending it, right? It's all that ancillary spending that happens around the consumer environment. So that's number one. Number two is, yes, you're right. In this recession, the upper tier has not been hit very hard, and they are continuing to spend because they have boatloads of money that they're not spending elsewhere, while people at the lower end of the spectrum are not spending. And you can see this data, you can see this in the data that comes out. They're not spending except when they get government relief, when they get their $1,400 checks or $600 checks, or when the relief unemployment insurance runs out. That spending lags, and then it pops back when those systems come back into place. So it is all about the totality of the data. It's not about actual consumers spending actual money, if that makes any sense, in any given month. That's that.
Right. Or it is, but it's not like the month that they spent it,
is,
it in.
It is, but it's not.
Or,
yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it is probably, as we've discussed a lot, not always either the right thing to focus on. Because just because, know, people who are doing fine financially are at home buying groceries and getting booze delivered and buying new couches and workout bikes and all of those things also doesn't mean that they're doing okay. We've talked a lot about like replacing GDP with a happiness index or an innovation index or some combination of both. So yes, there are lots of reasons not to focus on it as the only metric.
Yep. Lots of metrics. Okay. Last one before we go. Michael in Maryland, hit it.
Hey, y'all. Now that Paramount is in the streaming world, pretty much everybody now has their own app. And it got me thinking about what happens to Netflix now. The backbone of Netflix has always been those like perennial favorites like The Office or Friends. And now that the companies that initially produced them are pulling them back into their own ecosystems, we're left mostly with Netflix's original content, which, you know, there's a few hits, but most of it's pretty mediocre. So do you think Netflix will go the way of MySpace, really being the pioneers in a space then eventually losing out when everybody else catches up? Or do you think they'll figure out a way to stick around and be relevant?
Great question.
I totally think they're MySpace.
Do you really?
Yes. And here's why, because I keep talking about canceling Netflix constantly. In fact, just last night, we were having my son's little birthday dinner and talking about this exact thing, because everybody's in the same boat now, which is why is there always a new streaming service? Oh, God, there's another one. Oh, no, what about this one? I don't want to get that one.
And it's another $10 or $12 or whatever it is, you know? And pretty soon it's more money.
And so many of them keep coming out, and they all have a new cool thing or a reason that you want to watch it, and Netflix doesn't. And Netflix keeps getting more expensive. And so for Netflix to be like, we're going to make a movie a month, I think that was one of our half full, half empty.
Yeah, that's what they said. Yes, yes.
I don't know if that's going to cut it, and it is expensive, and the rivals are creeping up. It is going to be tough to win this race, because content's king.
I totally agree. You've thought about it more than I have, but I totally agree. But look, let me just do a very brief, small N number survey here. How many streaming services do you subscribe to right now, Molly Wood?
Dude, like all. It's ridiculous.
Okay.
I even subscribed to satellite radio. Actually, I canceled that one.
Oh my goodness.
So let's see. Radio. I have Netflix. I have Hulu. I have Disney Plus. I have HBO Max. I have... I'm in a little love affair right now with something like the Sundance something, because that's where I'm getting the French spy show that I'm watching.
I didn't even know that was a channel.
I have Amazon. I didn't know that either. And then there's probably Amazon, some that I have subscribed to and forgotten about that I'm still being charged for.
Right.
Like it's absurd. And every time a new one comes, Apple TV, I signed up for Apple TV so I could watch Ted Lasso, which I forgot to cancel and I'm still paying for. It's just...
Right.
And I do not mean to suggest I'm one of these people who has like nothing but money. It's just that apparently this is all we have to do is sign up for
But also you sign up and you forget about them, and you had a free trial, but you had to give a credit card and you forget to cancel it and this and that. And all this disaggregation, right? Because that's what's going on here. We used to have the cable bundles and now we've disaggregated and we can pick and choose. But you need a freaking spreadsheet to figure out which one to cancel, which one to activate. Is Game of Thrones coming on or do I need to turn on for the new season of Ted Lasso, right? And you're like, holy cow, man. And there's a maintenance pain in the buttness to this that irks me, which is why I asked. But I think you're right about Netflix. Sorry to get back to the answer to the question from Michael.
Yeah, it's really true. I think they're going to they had a first mover advantage, and now they're going to have a first mover disadvantage because everybody took their content and went home. And frankly, at some point, some genius company is going to come along and bundle it all together
It
in a package that looks surprisingly like cable, and it's probably going to be Comcast, and I'm going to be like, yes, please. Thank you very much.
and that's how put cable it on the wins blockchain in the end. And whatever. Oh, my God. All right. That is the cable TV end. So what do you want to know Wednesday for this week? Back tomorrow. Questions and comments, please. MakeMeSmart@Marketplace.org. Emails, good. Voice memos, better. Do it again, but better.
But better. Cable always wins.
True.
Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera, who is wonderful. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. We're just going to keep calling him that because we can. Erica Phillips writes our newsletters and our smart speaker skill.
Charlton Thorpe did the engineering magic today downtown. Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. Donna Tam is the senior producer. The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. And by the sound fading out of my headphones, I think we're getting through this one by the hair on our chinny chin chin. Thank you, my home internet service provider.